This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava. What makes a good society? It may be the underlying question, though not often articulated, in the 6 years since the 9/11 attacks. Rob Ryman has some thoughts on the subject. The author of The Nobility of Spirit says you can gauge the health of a society by the language it uses the most. Is it the language of the arts, used to express our most profound emotions and experiences, and to question why? Or, he asks, is it the more blunt language of the body, emphasizing force and violence? Ryman laments that truth and beauty are taking a backseat to money and entertainment. He says this kind of anti-intellectual culture is one that starves young people of opportunities to think critically, and he says it feeds religious and secular fundamentalism. Ryman suggests we might have only ourselves to blame if we don't seek out the arts and the books that promote freer thinking. He laid out his ideas in a speech at this summer's Aspen Ideas Festival, and it's that speech we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. The Aspen Ideas Festival brings together hundreds of artists, business people, politicians, and academics for a week of talks and speeches every summer in Aspen, Colorado. Rob Ryman is editor of the journal Nexus and founder of the Nexus Institute, which is based in the Netherlands. He spoke on July 3rd.
Now let me start with a very simple but important observation, which is the question, what is a good society, is as old as mankind, and more or less it became a forgotten question here in America. And I think I found the answer to this phenomenon a week ago when I could pay a visit to Ellis Island in New York. Coming to America already for more than a decade, never had the opportunity to be in New York and to go to Ellis Island. I did it together with my wife, and we went to Statue of Liberty, then the boat continues to Ellis Island, and we were deeply touched and moved by what we saw over there. And there was this great documentary with Gene Hackman as narrator, and you see all those images of hundreds of thousands of people, most of them without having anything, coming from Europe, coming from the old world to the new world, to the country of freedom, welcomed by the Statue of Liberty, hoping to, you know, to fulfill their American dream. And there is a beautiful face in the documentary where an old man says with his old voice, "You know what? Here in America, the police is there to help you," which was totally unexpected for them. In Russia, in Europe, that was not the case. So, I mean, we left Ellis Island with the impression what a great country America is. And within this context, within this mindset, it is understandable that the question, what is a good society, is not the top priority question if you already have the idea, at least I lived in the best part of the world. Things changed drastically with the key event of the 21st century, 9/11. Because the people responsible for 9/11 are religious people, pious people, they believe in law, even a holy law, and they have a crystal clear vision of what the good society is. And because of their vision of the good society, the idea of the West, America in particular, is the evil empire and it has to vanish from the world. Now, if we look for our blessing in disguise, the blessing in disguise with 9/11 might be that it is a horrible wake-up call for all of us to realize that the question, what is a good society, it is not an academic question. It is not just a philosophical question for a snobbish elite who play golf during the day and then afterward with a good glass of wine, oh yes, let's talk about a good society. The question, what is a good society, is the key question because the answer to that question has consequences for all aspects of our life, our society, even the world in which we are living. So the question is back on the table, but in its slipstream, some very, very tough questions, like, is the West, is America the better society, yes or no? And if we think it is, then why? Do we have an objective measure? If there is no objective measure, there is no idea of the good society, because then it all depends on, you know, a subjective idea of what is good. Where to look for this objective measure? In leadership, social economic issues, values? Okay, well, we take pride living in a society which is democratic, human rights, plurality, equality for law. But there are billions of people outside our world who do not share these values because they simply do not believe in them. Are they stupid? Are they ignorant? Are they in need of some enlightenment? What is going on? Now, before I turn to the more tough, difficult questions, probably it's a good idea to do a short fact-finding mission on what kind of society are we actually living in. What is it that we cultivate? What is the connective tissue of our world? And I've picked at random some examples of recent history. I'm a European, so recent history for me starts 100 years ago. And my first example is, let's go back to Paris, 1921, a French philosopher and poet, Paul Valéry. Paul Valéry, after World War I, writes a brilliant essay on the crisis of the human spirit. It is the human spirit that distinguishes from animals. It is because of the human spirit that we can transcend our physical instincts, that we have an idea about past and future, that we have the power of imagination, that we can have empathy, that we have some idea about what is good, truth, justice, freedom, and so on and so forth. But Paul Valéry notes that the human spirit of modern man got mixed up. And he writes, "We have become less sensitive and addicted to noise and excitement. And because we are less sensitive, we are constantly in need of stronger means to satisfy our own sense of excitement." Now, compare the movies of John Wayne, produced in the 50s or 60s, with what you're having now, Die Hard of Bruce Willis, Top Gun, Tom Cruise, Casino Royale, the latest James Bond, and suddenly John Wayne, which what was exciting in the 60s, is now very, very boring. Poof, 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 that's all you get. The same on the level of sex. It is not that long ago that even a nude part of the leg of a woman could arouse a lot of sexual excitement. Believe me, that is no longer the case. So, it is like drugs. We are addicted to it, we need more of it, it has to be stronger, and it also relates to the world of events. That's also an observation of Valéry. We are constantly in need of events, otherwise we feel bored and we feel empty, and the mass media understand this very well. That is the reason why they are constantly looking for breaking news, because only with breaking news they can draw our attention. And he continues with writing, "We are no longer living our lives ourselves. Our life is invaded by technology," and then he gives us an example, the phone, "because the phone invades our life and rules our life." He had no idea about BlackBerries, about cell phones. The same with work, with fashion, and what we get is a much more uniform society in which everybody dresses the same, thinks the same, speaks the same. So in a nutshell, what you get is the first formation of a mass society. Probably his most important observation was that he writes, 1921, keep this in mind, "Never before has our society been so superficial, because we are all focused on amusement and on games, but what a worries, what a fear, a constant state of panic." He is the first one to make the connection between a society which is focused on entertainment all the time and is constantly living in fear and panic. Compare 2007 with 1921. Now, obviously, this psychological, sociological developments must have consequences for a society. And then we have, a little bit later, but now in Spain, Ortega y Gasset, the Spanish philosopher who publishes his book, The Revolt of the Masses. His thesis is, well, finally Europe has its democracy as well. Finally Europe could get rid of those monarchs, aristocracy, power of the church. But at the horizon is coming a new form of totalitarianism incarnated by the mass man. Now, what is the mass man? The mass man is that type of man who is not interested in spiritual values, is not interested in knowing something about the truth. It is the type of man who thinks that he's completely entitled to any form of freedom, absolute freedom. Life has to be easy, no restrictions, please, no criticism, and demands instant satisfaction of all his physical and material needs. In this spiritual emptiness, looking for some form of gravity, the mass man adheres to the crowd. And what you get is the lonely crowd. Again, a new seed of totalitarianism, which will develop rapidly in the 30s in Europe. But more importantly is that Ortega y Gasset, again, is the first one to notice that the conduct of the crowd, of a mass, is not ruled by any form of morality, but by fear and desire. Now, the commercial world knows everything about desire, fulfilling desires, and even creating desires, if possible, by hypes. The latest hype to come, of the new hype to come, is the iPod phone, and, you know, it's a new desire created. And fear, well, you have a vice president and an advisor, Mr. Cheney, Mr. Rove, who know everything about conducting a mass by playing the card of fear all the time. At the end of the 40s, we have two brilliant Jewish intellectuals who could escape from Europe. They went to America, to Yale New Haven, Erich Kahle, Hermann Broch. And they wanted to find, now, what is the root of what all that is going on. And they started to reflect on what they call the decline of values. Where does that come from? What is going on in our society? Well, values, a value is something of such a significance that it guides our life and it helps us personally to decide what is important and what is not important. That is a value. And we used to have, according to them, a kind of general value, a kind of transcendental, spiritual idea and ideal of the dignity of man. This phenomenon is gone, and it is replaced by a whole series of autonomous, absolute, material values, like money. If you are focused on money, you're probably part of the business world, and all your decisions are related to money. Can I make money with it, yes or no? Power, you're probably part of the political world, and it relates to, will I gain more power, yes or no? And the same with science and technology. The consequence of it is that the most important criteria for our deeds have become self-interest and usefulness. And then with this, what we lost rapidly is a sense of general responsibility. It's no longer there. What you get is a society in which people who are working for a company are indoctrinated by corporate identity as the most important identity there is. And politicians no longer understand that they do have to serve the interest of a country, but they are basically serving the self-interest and the interest of the party. And in the world of the commercial world, there is no understanding of they will not ask the question, what is the relevance of my product? They will only ask the question, can I make profit, yes or no? Well, let's go to the 80s. In the 80s, we come across two Russians who could escape from the totalitarian USSR. I'm talking about the great cineast Andrei Tarkovsky. He went to Paris, and the great poet and later Nobel Prize winner Joseph Brodsky, who went to New York. Both men were absolutely stunned when they came into the free world, because they had to face the fact that the elites of the free world, the political world, the commercial, media, even the academic world, have given up on arts and culture. Oh yes, of course, it's still there on the fringe as a kind of enjoyable sideshow, but no longer at the center of the free world and its society. And they are stunned because they happen to believe that thinking and creating art belong to the highest activities of men. So Tarkovsky, in one of his essays, writes, "How is it possible that the free world replaced the world of art and culture by a mass culture? Because art and culture are there to help us to understand and to deal with the most profound existential questions of our life. But mass culture is a barrier between men and those questions, because the one message of mass culture all the time is, don't think, just be entertained." And Brodsky, in New York, writes two brilliant essays in which he argues, he says, look, I come from Russia, I know what censorship is, I had to deal with it, I had to go to prison, but even worse than censorship is the violence of non-reading, the neglect of books, the neglect of literature, the neglect of poetry. And literally he writes, for this crime, a man will pay with his whole life and a nation will pay with its history. And then he continues writing, he says, look, yes, I am worried about the continuation of my tradition, my culture, but I'm even more worried about the fate of men. Because art is the quintessential, unique instrument we have to understand and to communicate something of our most profound experiences, feelings, and emotions. You can only communicate all that is beyond words, beyond our day-to-day talk and chatter, through the language of art. Take this language away. People cannot communicate any longer. The only language they have left to express themselves is the language of the body, which is by definition violent. So, there is an immediate connection between the fact that there are no longer independent bookstores, the Gotham bookstore in New York is now also closed, between it's very, very difficult to sell poetry, that we do have the cult of a Mr. Schwarzenegger, Dirty Harry, Bruce Willis, which present this cult of manliness. You don't think, you don't ask questions, you keep your mouth shut, you just kill. And what happened at Virginia Tech? There is an immediate connection. Everybody who thinks that more security can prevent these disasters is a hypocrite and very, very stupid. We created a situation in which a whole generation of young people are no longer educated to communicate themselves because we have taken away the language. Well, one person would not have been surprised, and that is Richard Hofstadter, the great American historian who in 1962 published his book Anti-Intellectualism in America. And his big question is, how is it possible that there is so much resentment against the life of the mind in America? And he provides three answers. The first answer is that America, by its history, is future-oriented, forward-looking, and is in demand of, you know, practical things, concrete skills, know-how, and so on and so forth. It is in this context that Ford made his famous comment, history, tradition is bunk. The second answer of Hofstadter is that America is essentially a business-oriented culture. And a business-oriented culture is, by definition, the opposite of the life of the intellectual. The life of the intellectual is, and I think it's a magnificent definition, the capacity to turn answers into questions, to be critical, to have doubts, constantly asking and questioning yourself, self-examination. Now, this attitude is devastating for everybody who wants to make money in the business world. In the business world, you have to be a real man, a tough guy. You don't ask questions. You don't think. You just make the deal. You take the money and run. Otherwise, you're not very much a success. This is the attitude of Ford, Trump, Murdoch, and Mr. Babbitt, of this great novel of Sinclair Lewis. The third answer he provides is the impact of Christian fundamentalism in America. There's only one truth, which is in the Bible, which you have to read quite literally. There is the authority of the parents of the tradition, which is not allowed to be challenged. So you have to be obedient and please, no critical questions, no rational thinking, no ambiguities. This is the mindset of Bush, O'Reilly, and a few others outside.
You're listening to Word for Word from American Public Media and a speech by Rob Ryman, editor of the journal Nexus and author of The Nobility of Spirit.
So far, my examples, I have deliberately chosen my examples, most of them are coming from Europe, to make the point that there is not that much difference between America and Europe, although many Europeans want to believe that they are so different from America. It's not the case. Secondly, there is a common denominator behind almost all my examples, and that's what Nietzsche would have called nihilism. We are living in a very nihilistic society. We don't have the time to go into details, but to provide you a very short definition, nihilism means that nothing has any intrinsic value. Everything is related to, is it useful for me? What's in it for me? Is it good for me? Yes or no? And if the answer is no, or if at a certain moment the answer is no, things become meaningless. And that is what nihilism is, the cultivation of meaninglessness. And to escape from that, you get the kitsch culture, which pretend that things are beautiful and important, but as I argued last year when I gave a tutorial on kitsch, it's a form of beauty deprived of truth. It is empty. This year, as every year, the Time Top 100 of the most influential people has been published. If you look at it, I mean, it's definitely on the internet or maybe even in stores. In the top 100, you will not find one poet and not one philosopher. You will find politicians, a terrorist, Mr. Bin Laden, celebrities, philanthropical people, scientists, but not the two people of whom Brodsky and Tarkovsky thought that they are the example, the representation of the most important activities of men. Is this the good society? Well, let's have a brief look, and my apologies for being a little bit black and white. It's related to time, but also for the sake of argument. When I give a short description of conservatives and liberals, if I listen carefully what conservatives have to say here in America on the idea of the good society, I hear a lot of talk about spiritual values. But if I listen a little bit longer, I cannot escape from the impression that at the end of the day, what you have is more important than what you are. They can talk endlessly about Jesus and God, but I never hear them about the preaching of the mountain. And I also never get the impression that I do understand that the gospel is a radical revolt against injustice, poverty, materialism, and racism. They talk endlessly about the right way of life and how you have to behave, but it's always based on their instructions, on obedience. It looks as if they do not understand that life is a quest and that everybody has to have his own experiences of life before they can make their own decisions. Oh, yes, and freedom. Freedom is very, very important. But most of the time, they are more talking about the freedom to carry their own gun than what is the essence of true freedom. Liberals, if I hear liberals, I hear much more about social justice, about human rights, about equal opportunities. But essentially, it is a material worldview, a materialistic worldview. Spiritual values are too often reduced to social issues and social values. Liberals in general don't want to have a certain knowledge of the best because they think it relates to a kind of individual choice. What they do know is what is worst. Putting cruelty first. and they are against it. And therefore they insist on human rights, international institutions, international law, and so on and so forth. Now, obviously, this is key and it is very, very important. But the question is, can we build a good society when we only have knowledge of what is worst and don't have any knowledge of what is best? Among liberals, there is less anti-intellectualism than I notice in the conservative world, but there is a strong resentment against high culture, against the classics. It's considered to be elitist, anti-democratic, and in the liberal point of view, they don't want to make a difference between Madonna and Mozart. It's your own opinion. You have to find out what you think of it. Preparing my notes, I came across a great remark of a Danish philosopher who lived 150 years ago, Søren Kierkegaard, either or. And he comes with the following statement. Our age, I quote, reminds one very much of the disintegration of the Greek state. Everything continues, yet there is no one who believes in it. The invisible spiritual bond that gives its validity has vanished. End of quote. And when I read this remark, I thought, this seems to be very, very true for our own society. Yes, indeed, everything continues. But who still believes in it? History proves that in this kind of setting, we are preparing the grounds for populists, demagogues, charlatans, a lot of religious charlatans, and fundamentalists, last but not least. And the fundamentalists, whether they are religious or secular, they have a kind of common characteristics. First of all, as said, they have the pristine, crystal clear vision of the good society. No doubt at all about what it is. Secondly, in their worldview, the philosopher is king. The philosopher is president. There is always a priest or an intellectual who possesses the absolute knowledge of the truth. And they promise salvation. They promise the perfect society. They do have the perfect knowledge about what is good and what is bad. You have to pay a certain price. They don't accept any form of freedom because there should be obedience and authority. They are deeply anti-democratic, social engineering. There is a strong anti-intellectualism or a strong politicization of mind. The end always justifies the means. You can kill, you can murder, as long as it is for the holy goal. They do not know. They don't know anything about compassion, and they basically speak the grammar of death. It's the cultivation of death. Where it's Marxist-Leninism, where the Nazis, fascist, political Islam, Jewish fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, whatever there is, they all speak the grammar of death. So, are we stuck? Is this our situation? On the one hand, a still democratic society, but without an idea and without an ideal, rapidly disintegrating, and on the other hand, those who do know about the good society, but what they essentially basically bring is death and violence. The good news is there is hope because there is an alternative. There is a very, very serious alternative, which I would like to call the Socratic answer, the answer of Socrates. Socrates is my all-time favorite philosopher, lived 2,500 years ago in Greece. And he says, yes, there is an objective measure. We can know, we should know, what is best. But for him, it's not based on the grammar of death, it's based on the grammar of life. Now, what is his grammar of life all about? When he was put on trial and sentenced to death, he said to his fellow citizens in Athens, the only life worth living is a life based on self-examination. True life, real life, starts with asking critical questions all the time every day. What is it that I'm doing? Why am I doing it? What is it good for? And so the most important question, according to Socrates, is how do we ought to live? What is a good life? And with it, what is a good society? Now, Socrates thinks that at the very moment you're asking these questions, and you wake up in the morning and you look into the mirror, everybody will understand that we do have indeed this double nature. We are human beings. That is to say, we have our physical instincts, as Freud explained, our drift for violence, for aggression, for death, and for sex. But we also know about the world of ideas. We do know about beauty. We do know about freedom. We do know about justice. And so if we then ask the question, what is best? Socrates says, look, it is written in the grammar of life, which says, best is everything that gives life to life. Life-giving qualities, it's all about that. Love and friendship are a life-giving quality because they can transform something of physical instincts into a spiritual value. Beauty is a life-giving quality because it can transform something what is just material in something timeless. And it is a life-giving quality because people, when they are in despair and there is beauty, they are reminded by the fact that another world, another life is possible. Forgiveness is a life-giving quality because a relationship which has been dead and died can be reborn again. Truth is a life-giving quality because something what is meaningless can be transformed in something meaningful. And we all know this. We all know that beauty, goodness, truth, justice, freedom are the qualities that dignify our lives. And as Socrates says, it reminds us that our real identity is an identity, is not what we are, but what we should be. Carrier of those everlasting, life-giving qualities, values, and virtues. But we don't get it for free. We are not born with them. We cannot download them. We cannot buy them. We need education. Lifelong education. What kind of education? Liberal education. Because the true essence of liberal education is that it sets us free. It liberates us from fear. It liberates us from stupidity. It liberates us from the idea that life is only about power, ambition, and all these things. It reminds us that life is essentially about the cultivation of the nobility of spirit. The nobility of spirit, that is true freedom. That is what the dignity of life is all about. George Steiner, a great philosopher and a great friend of mine, once wrote, "The dignity of man is realization of wisdom, pursuit of disinterested knowledge, creation of beauty, making money, and flooding our lives with increasing trivialized material goods is a profoundly vulgar, emptying passion." How does liberal education function? Well, it is the education in philosophy, because philosophy is the great phrase of Hofstadter, turning answers into questions. Philosophy teaches us to question. Philosophy is about self-examination. Philosophy is about training ourselves to think. And it is an education in arts, because it is only arts which can help us to communicate our most important emotions and feelings, but also it gives this brilliant insight in what the essence of truth is. And to give you one short example, during World War II, a Polish Jewish poet was imprisoned in Moscow. He was in the Lubyanka prison. And the regime at the Lubyanka prison was that at the end of the morning, the prisoners could go to the roof. They could make a short walk of around 45 minutes to get some fresh air, and then they had to go inside. And in his memoir, My Century, he tells that it was April, it was early spring, it was a beautiful morning, and there was some wind which gently made him listen to some fragments of the Matthew Passion. Somewhere there was a choir and an orchestra rehearsing for the Matthew Passion. And he writes, that he stood still. He could not move anymore. If the human voice, man-made instruments, and the human soul can create such harmony, beauty, truth, power in such a unity of inspiration, if this exists, how ephemeral, what a non-entity, all the might of the Soviet Empire must be. This was his life-saving moment. This was what made him survive this prison. Primo Levi, in his memoir, If This Is a Man, exactly the same story. Levi survived Auschwitz because a recollection of a certain fragment of the Divine Comedy of Dante. Art is a life-giving quality because it is the essence of life itself. So, if at the end of this trial, Socrates says to his fellow citizens, I quote, "Are you not ashamed that you make every effort to gather as much money as you can, but you are not concerned about insight, truth, and well-being of your soul? Well, as long as I live, I'll confront you with the fact that you neglect the most important in favor of what is less important." And let us be honest, because how much of our life, energy, time is wasted on the less important instead of the most important? That's the only explanation why we got this Time Top 100, why we have this cult of celebrities, why we have the education which we are having, why we are living in this commercial, basically nihilistic society. My final remark, we are responsible. Nobody else. And it's foolish and quite hypocritical to put blame on a Bush administration and all that kind of guys. We are responsible. If we don't buy something, the product is gone. If we don't watch Fox television, Fox television is gone. If we don't elect those people, they will not be there. If people do not read books, if they do not read poetry, Henry James, Proust, Dostoevsky, it is because we stopped reading. If people think that money is the key thing in their life, it is because we made it the key thing in our life. Now, Socrates was wise enough never to claim any political power. He understood that politics is a different art, and he had a good hunch that most philosophers are probably very, very terrible presidents. But what he did claim, and he paid for it with his life, is that we can never have a good society if we don't educate ourselves in the grammar of life, if we don't practice the nobility of spirit, and if it is not this philosophy that presides over our life. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Rob Ryman is author of The Nobility of Spirit, and he's editor of the journal Nexus. In the mid-1990s, he founded the Nexus Institute based in the Netherlands. Rob Ryman spoke at the Aspen Ideas Festival on July 3rd, and you're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After his speech, Ryman took questions from the audience.
Not so much a question, but a comment. What you said may be rather shocking to a lot of people in the audience. Could be an assault on some values that people hold here, but to place your comments in history, Mortimer Adler, who was the philosopher in residence here for many years, claimed that Aspen was under a contest between two philosophical triads. One, the good, the true, and the beautiful. The other, money, fame, and power. He said that in the 1960s. I leave it up to your own judgment as to where we are today. Thank you.
Look, I'm presiding over a cultural institute myself, together with my wife. And given the mindset in which we are living, not easy to get the public attention, to get the media attention. And, you know, something only works when you get this attention, because when you are in the media, it's important. Fundraising become much more simple, and so on and so forth. So you always try to find a balance between what is attractive on the one side, what will, you know, why people are eager to come, and, quote unquote, not to diminish anybody, you put into the real quality of unknown people whom people have never heard of. If we would put together a conference with only very, very interesting people, but unknown to the audience, nobody would come. But if you organize a conference and you manage to get Ann Clinton and Rove and Lance Armstrong, so, I mean, it's a kind of salami technique which is also used in the classical world. You put Mozart, but you also include Stockhausen. Please.
Hi. I'm hoping you can comment on something that's happening in psychology now, a movement in positive psychology that seems to go along with what you're talking about. There seems to be more of a movement toward what they call character strengths and virtues and values in action. And Martin Seligman and Christopher Peterson have outlined six sort of domains of character strengths, which is a really new movement in psychology considering our history of self-absorption in psychology. Are you aware, facilitating any of this, or is this just happening on its own?
No, look, I was not aware of it. This is new for me. But what is not new for me is that there are always things in the air. It is not for nothing that I think that the Aspen Festival is pretty unique, but it's growing, and there are more of it. One idea is always shared by many more people, because we are all human beings. We all are eager to get some quality in our life. We all can notice the emptiness we have cultivated for so long. And so that's, you know, we are on the balance of, you know, what will happen in the next 2 decades. Will we go back into the traps of things we experienced in Europe in the 30s? If you have read Philip Roth's The Plot Against America, I mean, this beautiful description of how easy history could have been different. It only takes this, not that much. So we can only applaud when in all segments of society people start to realize, hey, we have to do things differently.
I'm a Bezos scholar, and you touched upon teaching students how to think, not just teaching them rote information. I'm wondering if you can expand on that and how you would presume that we might, or think that we might be able to do something with that in our school systems today.
Well, I always say to a lot of, I'm 45, so I'm no longer a student. I was a student for a long time. And I had basically I used my time, I studied for 10 years, and I only read books. Not exactly knowing what to do with it after it, but I read books. I have no regret at all. I think that for young people it is a mistake if they follow the wise advice of young man, young girl, be practical, think about your future, do something with which you can make money, and so on and so forth. My advice would be follow your passion. Follow your passion and understand that life is more about just making money. And so when you go to that, look, I mean, the great thing about America for us Europeans is you have both. On the one hand, you have horrible things, but at the same time, you're still having such magnificent instruments we are not having in Europe. The best liberal art colleges are here in America. If you have this passion, go to them, if you can afford them. So that's, and also, you know, sometimes I imagine what would happen to our educational system if all students decide for 1 year, we stop, we will not go, we don't pay them, stop with it. Why not? No? A universal strike. That would have impact. Then things change rapidly. So again, the point I wanted to make, and this is my optimism is based on, and it's your expression, you can make the difference. We can make the difference. And that's the power you have, because we are living in a democracy. If we would not live in a democracy, things are different. But we are still living in a democracy. So use that power. We the people, be aware of it. Sorry, one more question.
Sorry, just one quick question. Speaking of, you touched on how difficult it is to reach the media and following your passion. Mine in particular is I'm an aspiring filmmaker. What advice can you offer to people, I mean, any aspiring artist in general, when the art world, especially things like music, television, and movies, are so dominated by this public interest that's interested in fame, money, success, and commercial appeal?
Well, I have a view about this. Our institute, the Nexus Institute, is a tiny independent institute in the Netherlands. And we have a growing audience. Don't laugh. We have now 2,500 members. For the Netherlands, with only 60 million people, a society which is not that much different from America, that's a lot. And you know what? One of the things we discovered is that the things go wrong on the supplier side. Again, I don't want to insult anybody, but there are the producers, the people in charge who think, oh, the people will not be interested in it, so we cannot do this, and so on and so forth. It is not true. It is not true. There is much more interest than there is. The trick is you have to get it out of the system. You have to move out of the system. And maybe, we have to realize that we have to start from a scratch. That's the feeling I have all the time. We really have to start from a scratch.
I did not know of you before today or your institute. If one wanted to pursue some of your writings or the institute, how would we get access to them?
There is the website, www.nexus-institute.nl. You have to have patience for 1 year, but next year I'm proud to inform you that Yale University Press will publish my book on the nobility of spirit. And thank you. It's an,
I'd like to stay right on the Virginia Tech issue, because that was quite profound in your early speech, and I'd like to extend that.
Well, the question was from the back of the audience. If I could comment a little bit on my statement on a non-reading of poetry and what happened at Virginia Tech. Let me tell you a small anecdote. A couple of years ago, I was at a friend of mine. And my institute, the Nexus Institute, was preparing a huge conference on the identity of Europe as part of the Dutch EU presidency. And my friend is, she's from Czech, Jewish, living in London, upper class family. So doing a kind of fact-finding mission on Europe is something the youth is interested in. I asked her, quite brilliant son, who is, he was then 23 or something like that. Do you consider yourself a European, yes or no? I wanted to know. And he said, no, not really. He said, why not? He said, I asked, why not? He said, well, you know, I have no idea about it. It has never been part of our education and so on and so forth. I said, but I said, you know, you have had a great education. I mean, you have gone to this important private school in London and so on and so forth. He said, Rob, you're mistaken. He said, let me tell you the following. A week ago, the father of my best friend died. And we young kids went to this friend and they sat together and there was some music and they drank a beer and another beer. He said, there was nothing we could say. And he said, we felt helpless and hopeless. And he said, I talked about this with my mother and she said, you know, you're poorly educated. And so this is the thing, you know, at the very moment that life is there, when you are really confronted with life, you really experience what you know, the language you have and which you don't have. And as said, it's perfectly clear for everybody that, and look, even on a Hollywood level, right? That's Poet Society and all that kind of movies. It's very Hollywood, it's very romantic, but they are making a point. If you don't learn kids the language to express themselves, at the very moment something happens, you know, they feel frustrated. If you are frustrated and you cannot express yourself, the only thing you can do is become violent. And one of the things that drives me crazy is that we are living in the richest world ever imaginable. There is so much money. We can have such an excellent education, and we are wasting so much of it. Thank you.
Rob Ryman is editor of the journal Nexus and founder of the Nexus Institute in the Netherlands, which debates and reflects on the social, philosophical, and artistic aspects of European culture. He is also author of the book, The Nobility of Spirit. If you missed part of this hour's speech by Rob Ryman, or if you would just like to hear it again, our website, wordforword.org, is the place to go. There you can hear this week's show, subscribe to our free weekly podcast, and also listen to any of our previous programs, including speeches by Fiasco author and journalist Thomas Ricks, Iraq scholar Ellen Lapson, and writer Norman Mailer. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penkava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert, Larissa Anderson, and Susan Leem, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.